Welcome to Rails with Jason. Hey, I want to tell you about something. If you struggle with writing tests for your Rails applications, specifically RSpec tests, I have something for you. At my website, codewithjason.com, I have a whole bunch of articles on Rails testing that I wrote. Here's a couple examples of what you can find there. You can find a repeatable step-by-step guide to writing integration tests with Capybara. That's where I share my formula that I use every time I write a Capybara test that makes it pretty easy. There is the ultimate guide to RSpec and Capybara tests. And there's also mocks and stubs in plain English. These are just a few examples of dozens and dozens of Rails testing articles that I've written at codewithjason.com. I also have a free Ruby testing micro course that you can download. It's a four-part course, pretty easy to go through. Hundreds of developers have already downloaded the course. You can join them by going to codewithjason.com and downloading the micro course. I also have a book called Rails Testing for Beginners. The book can be purchased as just the book or the book plus a video package where I walk through the book and show you everything in the book. Again, all these things are available at codewithjason.com. Now on to the episode. Welcome to Rails with Jason. I'm here today with guest Mike Parham, creator of Sidekick. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Jason. Glad to be here.
So, Mike, I think a lot of people are familiar with you and with Sidekick, but do you want to give us a little intro and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I've been doing Ruby and Rails since about 2006 or so when it came out. I loved it from day one and was so excited to get into the ecosystem after about a decade in Java. And so I started playing more and more with open source and developed half a dozen open source gems, but found myself always coming back to concurrency and threading and background jobs. And that's, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm curious about that. So like, obviously I know about Sidekick, but I'm not really familiar with anything else you might've created before or after that. So what else have you created in terms of gems?
Yeah, so other gems that you might have used is the most popular other one that I created was called Dolly. It's the main Memcached client
that you would used that, but I didn't know that was you.
Yeah, I was the original author of that. I turned over maintenance of it 4 or 5 years ago now at this point to Peter Goldstein, but I was the original author and did probably 90% of the original work to get it up and running.
Okay.
But I did that. I did a gem called Data Fabric, which was a database sharding gem. I also mentored the fellow who wrote Octopus, which is sort of a later generation DB sharding gem. And of course, now Rails 6 has DB sharding kind of built into it. So all that stuff is water under the bridge at this point.
Okay.
I wrote a gem called Bayes Motel, which was a Bayesian filtering library, an API to do Bayesian filtering.
So you did Java for like 10 years and then you came to Rails around 2006. So you came into Ruby and Rails already being like a pretty experienced developer, it sounds like. How long was it between the time you started doing Rails and the time you first started creating your own open source projects?
Yeah, so it wasn't very long. I started work at a company called Five Runs in Austin, Texas. They were willing to hire me as a senior Java developer. They were willing to hire me and train me as a Rubyist because I was looking for a job doing Ruby full time, but obviously I didn't have any professional experience with it. But in building our products, which was software SaaS like you might see anywhere these days. We needed some of the open source gems that we were using. We needed maintenance of them. They were buggy and had issues here and there. And so I just sort of fell into that. We were actually trying to use Memcache. And so I took over maintenance of the Memcached client that was out there. And I performance tuned that and got something like 10 times the performance that it previously had. And that's kind of where Dolly followed up from, is I had had enough of the Memcache client API and the code base, and I wanted to write sort of a next generation implementation of it.
I see.
But that Memcache client was my first toe in the water of Ruby open source. And from there, I authored a bunch of different gems.
Okay.
The one that I did before Sidekick was a gem called Girl Friday, and that was a background job gem that was based on Threads, but it was in process. It wasn't like Sidekick in that you had a separate process running. The closest thing these days is a gem called Sucker Punch, which is sort of a philosophical follow-up to Girl Friday.
Okay. My head is swimming with questions. One of my biggest challenges on this show is that I have guests on and they talk and they mention all these different things. And I'm like, what's that? Oh, what's that? What's that? And I like haven't heard of all these things. So out of the 1,000 different directions we could go from here, let me ask this. Does it seem easier or harder, or maybe even you can't really tell, but with your perspective of having started pretty early in the life of Rails, was it easier back then to like recognize opportunities for like gaps to fill in, you know, like, oh, we don't have an open source thing for this, so somebody needs to create this, so maybe I'll create it, versus now where like the ecosystem is more mature and there are maybe fewer gaps?
I mean, I think that is the reality, is that any ecosystem, as it gets more popular and as it gets more inhabited, people tend to polish over the rough edges, right? And so, you know, people talked about 10 years ago, talked about the Java ecosystem and how it had a library for everything, and how, why would anyone pick anything but Java? Because it had all these polished, well-developed, bug-free libraries. And that was certainly true back then, and it was not true of Ruby. But it is true of Ruby these days, because we've had that decade of a large influx of developers who have sort of scratched their own itch and sandpapered over those rough edges, any rough edges that they've found. So I think you're onto something. I think it is a little bit harder these days to find opportunities in the Ruby world, because a lot of them have already been solved.
Yeah. I've had kind of a nagging desire over the years to like build my own open source project and kind of make my mark and that kind of thing. And so I started with Rails in like 2011, which at the time felt so late to the game, but now that was like 8 years ago, which is kind of funny. But I never like could really think of anything. And then this year, so 8 years into using Rails and wanting to make some kind of gem, I finally thought of something. And the thing I came up with was I call it migration builder, because there's this challenge that I have that I think a lot of Rails developers do, where anytime I create a migration that's like non-trivial, I have to go and Google the syntax for like, okay, how exactly do I add a reference to an existing table? I know roughly how to do that, but like, I don't remember the exact syntax, and that's annoying to have to look that up. So I created this thing that's like an interactive series of prompts that creates your migration for you. And that, it got what is for me pretty satisfying traction measured by GitHub stars. I got 20 GitHub stars. And so I'm like, wow, this is more than like, you know, if I got 2, that would be like, yeah, whatever. But hey, 20 people think this is compelling enough to click that star button. So that's been.
Well, yeah, I'm happy you found a niche that you could explore and feel like you're adding value to the community. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, and from a purely selfish standpoint, I've made my own life easier because now I don't have to Google that migration syntax quite as much. So that's been good. When you first got into creating Sidekick, like, how did that? Well, if you can maybe just like briefly get into how that came about, and then like, what did those early days look like in terms of getting traction? Was it something that like you had to work to make people aware of, or did it kind of take off on its own, or how did that go?
Yeah. So, Sidekick sprung out of a need that I saw, as a consultant for a Silicon Valley startup. They were doing a lot of background processing and they were using Rescue, and they were also a banking startup. So they were also using JRuby because it was, you know, Java. They wanted the enterprise kudos and enterprise readiness of the Java VM. So they had everything running on JRuby. The problem is that Rescue is single-threaded, and the JRuby takes and the Java VM take a huge amount of memory. So they were running just dozens of machines and tons of RAM.
Let me stop you there because I hardly understood anything you just said. We'll have to unpack like several different parts of this. So first of all, I have heard of JRuby, heard of the JVM. I don't really understand what those are or like why exactly, what's the use case for using those instead of just like regular Ruby? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Right. Sure. So the Java VM is the runtime that executes Java code. So if you have Java code, you hand the compiled Java application to the Java VM and it executes it and runs your application. In the same way that the Ruby command runs your Ruby code. The difference is that JRuby is kind of a bridge that allows you to run Ruby code directly on the Java VM. So it will take your Ruby code and transpile it into Java bytecode. And so then the Java VM knows how to execute Java bytecode. So it's a very complex system, but the reason why large companies want to use the Java VM is because it's very well established. It has a very broad set of commercial tools that you can use to debug it, profile it, monitor it, that sort of thing.
So there's a number of... If you're using JRuby, then you could take advantage of these tools that were targeted at Java and use them on your Ruby project? Is that the idea?
Exactly. So like if you have an IT organization whose system administrators only are willing to deploy Java applications, you can sort of sneak your Ruby application in to the organization by using JRuby. So to the Java VM and to those sysadmins, it just looks like another Java application. But you're, as a developer, you are writing Ruby code.
Got it. Okay.
Kind of a strange sort of niche, but you know, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of companies around the world that do this.
Okay, I see. Yeah, that's super interesting to know because I've come across JRuby and JVM so many times, and every time I see it, I'm like, yeah, but why? And nobody ever, I guess everybody kind of assumes that it's obvious why or something like that. I never understood it before now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other thing that the Java VM has as an advantage is it has actual real threading. So it will take advantage of as many cores on a machine as you give it. So if you've got a 16 or 32 core machine, that JVM can theoretically take advantage of all those cores with one process. Whereas the normal Ruby MRI can only use one core at a time. because it has that global interpreter lock. And okay. So what you find is that people who want to scale their Ruby app will fork off processes. And that's why Puma has this sort of hybrid mode where you can tell it to use a certain number of threads, but you can also tell it to use a certain number of processes too.
Okay, let's talk about this. I don't remember if I use this analogy on the air before, but I play guitar, and like I'm pretty decent at guitar, but I don't know anything about guitars. So because like you don't really need to know anything about the guitar to play music. Right. And I'm kind of that way as a programmer too. Like I can program pretty good, I think, but I don't know a lot about like the actual hardware and stuff like that. So let's talk about threads and processes and all that kind of stuff. I had Nate Berkopek on the show recently, and he and I talked about, I think, threads and connection pools, which are two things that I didn't really understand. Now I understand mm-hmm. them a little bit more than I did before, but let's see if I have this right. Okay. So if something, let's say you have a thing that is single threaded and I have a computer that has four cores, because that thing is single threaded, it can't make use of my four cores. It can only run one thing at a time. Whereas if it were multi-threaded, it could run four things in parallel because of those four cores. Is that the right idea?
Theoretically, yes, exactly. You have four points of execution, four things that can execute at the same time. So you okay. should be able to put those on four different cores and have them run in parallel.
I see. Okay. And so now maybe I'm a little bit better equipped to understand some of the things you said earlier. You said rescue is single-threaded, and so you wanted something that could take advantage of, you wanted something that could have more parallelism. Can you kind of say that again? So like, I didn't quite catch it the first time.
Yeah, well, rescue being single-threaded means that it has no concurrency at all. Right, it can't run multiple things at a time. And so if you want to get concurrency so that one process can take advantage of multiple cores, you need to create many threads. And so that's where I was getting at with regard to the JVM, is if you are running a single-threaded JVM process, each JVM may take 1 gigabyte. And so if you want to take advantage of 32 cores, you've got to start up 32 copies of that JVM process. And so that's 32 gigs of memory now, which is ridiculous. It blows my mind.
Okay. So you're talking about if you want to have those 32 different things under rescue, because it's single threaded, you have to have 32 separate processes. And so you exactly. have to have 32 VMs running.
Right. Whereas if you take something like Sidekick, which I built because of this need, you know, with Sidekick, you can start it up with 32 threads and it's just a single process, but you could run it in JRuby. And now you've got 32 Sidekick threads running on the JVM. So now that JVM may only take, let's say, 2 gigabytes of RAM to run 32 threads. So you're still taking advantage of 32 cores, but now your memory usage has gone from 32 gigabytes down to 2 gigabytes. Got so it. It's a huge win.
Yeah. And I imagine that it's not trivially easy to write something that is multi-threaded. Otherwise, rescue just would have turned on the multi-threaded setting. Is that the right assumption? I
mean, well, I think there's a little historical baggage here. Ruby for the longest time had a reputation as being not thread friendly. So Matz has always said that threads are not a great pattern, not a great API. They're hard to use, right? And I agree with him. You know, I developed Sidekick and the connection pool gem so that we would have multi-threaded architecture. And it took 3 or 4 years before I started seeing no concurrency bugs in the software. In other words, you know, 3 or 4 years after I had created Sidekick, people were still reporting concurrency bugs. Now, they were usually very rare, you know, very edge casey, but they were still there. So that it goes to show you that threading is hard to do.
And those must have been those bugs must have been real beasts to track down and reproduce and all that.
Oh boy, you have no idea. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, my hat goes off to some of these developers who found it, because there's no way I would have found it. I mean, it's, you know, the sweat and hard work of weeks of debugging to track this kind of stuff down.
Wow.
So, you know, that's the power of open source for you, is once people have the source, they can actually dive in, they can instrument it, they can debug it, and then they just send you a one-line PR which says, here's the use case and here's why it failed and here's the fix. And it's absolutely wonderful as a maintainer. But it's not fun to get, you know, bug reports that have no reproducible test case that you just can't really do anything with. That's the hardest part of it.
Yeah. We'll just close it as cannot reproduce. Then you're done.
The problem is when 100 people report it, then you know there's something there.
Oh, man. Yeah. Okay. So 100 people reporting something, nobody knows how to reproduce it reliably.
Yeah, it wasn't that bad. But I mean, I had one particular bug in the batch feature of Sidekick Pro that people reported for probably 2 years. And it just gnawed at me the entire time, because I knew there was something there, but I had no idea what was happening, what was going wrong. And it did take me probably 3 years to find and fix this bug.
Wow.
But that just goes to show you that sometimes these bugs are super subtle and just epic journeys.
That must have been so satisfying, though, to finally fix that.
It was, because once I fixed it and put out a new release and started telling people that had reported the bug about the release, then I literally never heard about that bug ever again. And it was a thing of beauty.
That's great.
To just not have this mystery, you know, pecking at me anymore.
So I saw in the Reddit/r/Ruby recently that Sidekick 6 came out. That was just like a few days ago as of this recording, right?
Yeah, that's right. I released it on, I think, Friday last week. As a soft launch, and then I announced it on Tuesday. But it's mm-hmm. It's the product of 6 to 9 months of work.
Okay.
Testing it with Rails 6, merging in various bug fixes and a couple features that people had kindly submitted. One feature did not get into 6 that I would have loved to have seen, but somebody brought up the idea of adding dark mode support to the web UI. And I thought that was a really cool idea. But
is the reason why it's version 6, is that just coincidental that it's roughly coinciding with Rails 6, or do the versions track each other?
I mean, at this point, I try to track Rails. So I probably wouldn't release a Sidekick 7 until Rails 7 comes out.
Okay.
But that said, that's a weekly held belief. If I need to release a Sidekick 7 because of some major change, then I will do that. But I don't see that on the horizon. So at this point, I just like to keep them in sync so that it's obvious to people which version works best with which version of Rails.
Got it. So I want to talk a little bit about a personal experience I've recently had with Sidekick. I've never used Sidekick or any background job processor very much in my work. For whatever reason, so often in my career, I've ended up developing like back office type applications where there's not really a lot of like performance requirements or anything like that, and certainly not a lot of like background job type stuff. But an application I've been working on recently, it's actually pretty interesting, where we're sending faxes through the application. So like, I don't know, a couple dozen times a day, we'll say fax this document to this person.
Okay.
And the fax sending takes up to, I don't know, like up to 3 minutes or something like that. So obviously it would be, it's not going to work to just wait for the page to load for 3 minutes because it would time out. Mm-hmm. So we pretty much had to do the background job thing. And it's kind of funny because the API has a frustrating characteristic where it rate limits so that you can send as many faxes as you want, as far as I can tell, but you can only check globally. You're only allowed to check on the status of faxes once every 6 seconds. So you could kick off 100 faxes sending right now if you want, but you could only do a check once every 6 seconds to, you know, and that's not like you can't have 100 things going at once at each check every 6 seconds. No, it's just every 6 seconds you can check once. So it's the opposite of normal where concurrency is actually, we can't have concurrency. So I set the sidekick concurrency to just one.
Right.
And that's been working out great. But then I found, and this is not like, this has nothing to do with, it's not a criticism of Sidekick or anything like that, but figuring out how to get it deployed to production was a little bit of a challenge. Just because surprisingly, there's not like a ton of documentation out there that I found that says, here's how you deploy Sidekick to AWS and EC2 and all that stuff. But I found out.
Yeah, I mean that's mm-hmm. the issue there. The issue there is that there's 100 different ways to deploy, right? Yeah. And I can't document every single one of them. They're all so specific to every single system. The easiest is probably Heroku, right? But if you're using EC2, then you're running your own Linux distro, which means you're managing your own services. Which means, you know, you're getting into Linux system administration, which is another thing that I don't necessarily want to document and help people out with. You know, I figure that if you're running your own Linux systems, you probably know how to administer them. It's not my place to necessarily teach that to people. But, you know, you get into things like ECS and Fargate and Kubernetes and Docker, and there's just so many different layers and so many different ways to mix and match these tools that there's no every single person has a different way of deploying almost, it seems like.
Yeah. No, I am 100%.
That's the frustration there.
I'm 100% with you that like it would be crazy for you to try to document all the different ways you could configure Sidekick with a like even just deploying Rails to Ada, like forget about Sidekick. Just deploying Rails to AWS, good luck finding a guide out there that will say, here's a way, not the way, just a way. Here's a way to deploy Rails to AWS, a tutorial that you can follow note for note, and it actually works. In my experience, no such thing exists, which is crazy that that's the case, but it seems to really be the case.
I mean, that's literally the business case for Heroku, right? I mean, if you want to deploy your Rails app to AWS, the answer is go create a Heroku app and git push Heroku master, right? Yeah. I mean, that's literally what they were created to solve, was that deployment struggle. Yeah. So the struggle is and continues to remain real.
That's true. Just out of curiosity, is there like a standard path for like, okay, so if you're deploying Rails to Heroku, that's pretty straightforward. You run Heroku create, git push Heroku master, and generally you're good. Is there kind of one way of adding Sidekick to that mix, or are there multiple different ways you could handle that?
Did you say if you're on Heroku? Is this Heroku you're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, Heroku has the concept of a worker dyno, which is a dyno that is up 24/7, but does not accept web requests. So it's literally there to pull work from a queue. So yeah, you would create not only a web dyno, but you'd create a worker dyno in your proc file.
And then do you have to like somehow get a Redis instance going as part of that too?
Generally, that's the idea is you would sign up for one of the Redis SaaSes that have Heroku add-ons, and they'll add, you know, $49 a month or whatever to your Heroku bill. And in return, you now have a Redis instance, which is up in production. And typically we'll do things like hourly backups and maybe real-time failover, depending on, you know, what sort of what level of service you've purchased. But they'll be typically add-ons that will add managed Redis servers to your application.
Yeah, in my particular case, my load is light enough that I was able to get away with just running the Sidekick process right on my. I just have one EC2 instance for the whole application because it's like two offices worth of a grand total of like 20 people or something like that using the application. So like very light load. And so we only need one EC2 instance, and I could just run Sidekick on that. The challenge that I had and the difficult part for me to figure out was what happens if I restart that server. I don't want to have to manually remember to go and start the Sidekick process again. And obviously this is like an AWS specific thing, not a Sidekick specific thing, but I had to like wire up some instructions to tell AWS, hey, on startup, get Sidekick going. That was actually pretty tricky for me to figure out. But once I did that, then it was good.
Are you using just a plain old EC2 instance running like Ubuntu or something like that?
Yeah, it's Elastic Beanstalk running Amazon Linux.
Okay, got it. Yeah. Typically I tell people to create a systemd service or upstart service so that when the machine is rebooted, the system will start up those services just like any other system service.
What is systemd?
Systemd is the init process for the entire operating system. So it starts up important services on the machine. And I mean, that machine exists for your business app, right? So you should be creating services in systemd so that the operating system will boot Sidekick the minute it starts up.
Yeah, okay.
And that's what I, if you go to the deployment wiki page for Sidekick, that's what I stress heavily to everybody is if you're running Linux and you're managing the services yourself, do it through systemd or upstart. Because a lot of people in the past, historically, have used Capistrano and they've just bundle exec Sidekick and then spun off a process. The problem with that being that is if the process crashes, who restarts it? The answer is nobody. Yeah. The answer is you when you discover that nothing's running. So that's why I keep beating the dead horse of, you know, learn to create system services so that the operating system can monitor this thing for you.
And when you say system services, you mean like the thing you would spin up in systemd, so it's kind of guaranteed to be running.
Yeah, it's just a simple text file that describes to systemd the name of this thing, the command it should run, things like that. Just really things like, you know, where, what should it do? What should system do? Systemd do for logging? So how should it treat its logs? What else?
I wonder exactly why on Elastic Beanstalk, AWS Elastic Beanstalk, the way people seem to be doing that kind of stuff is through like a .eb extensions file that has like, it was like a pretty non-trivial file in terms of what it had in it. I wonder why that instead of just some kind of systemd thing. I assume there's a good reason. I just have no idea what it might be.
It's a good question. I don't know Amazon Linux, but it could be that Amazon Linux is not based on systemd.
It is, so Amazon Linux, I think, is just basically CentOS for what it's worth.
And it's probably CentOS 6 or some really ancient version,
okay.
which would not be systemd. But I can kind of understand that. I mean, these system services have been in flux, you know, for years. People were just using initd bash scripts, and then Upstart came along, and some people liked Upstart, some people obviously wanted something different, and they created systemd. There was another one called Runit, which was another init system that was mildly popular for a bit. Yeah, it was in flux for a long time. I mean, it seems to have settled down, and systemd seems to have gotten essentially 100% of the market share at this point. So there's no point in kind of avoiding it at this point. But yeah, I mean, for something as ancient as Amazon Linux, they don't have that system there for people to use.
So I'm going to switch gears and ask about a totally different topic. So obviously, like, you've seen a lot of different use cases for Sidekick in the years that it's been running. If I'm a pretty new and experienced developer and I want to know, like, okay, when should I keep my eyes out for, like, what's a good use case for something like Sidekick? What are some of those things where, like, if I'm doing a certain thing, Sidekick is a good tool to help with that?
Sure. So I think of the best use case for Sidekick is if you're making some sort of third-party call, and it doesn't need to happen right at this very second. So if somebody presses a button and that fires off sort of 10 different business transactions that need to happen, but they don't need to, like, happen as part of that button push, like the user doesn't need immediate feedback, then to me that is a use case for breaking those 10 different transactions into 10 different background jobs that can all execute in parallel. And that by breaking them into 10 separate units, they don't depend on each other now either. So if the first one fails, the next 9 can still execute and finish just fine.
Oh,
does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Could you happen to come up with any examples of such a thing? Like, what kinds of external services might you be calling, I wonder?
Sure. I mean, you could be anything from as simple as sending an email, right? You register as a user on a website.
Oh,
you
okay.
You want to send the user an email.
Yeah. Okay.
But if that user's email server is down, you don't want that to cause an error to appear in the UI, right?
Yeah.
You want it to be best effort, kind of like welcome to the site. But if they don't get a welcome to the site email, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah. So, like, I can imagine a page where, like, you buy something, and so it needs to kick off an API request to Stripe, and it also sends an email. So there's, like, two things. If either one of those things failed or, like, took a long time for some reason, you wouldn't either want to fail the whole thing or make the whole thing take a long time. Those would be good candidates for background jobs.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I wrote a large bulk of Sidekick when I was a director of engineering at an e-commerce startup. So we had we were selling jackets and pants and shirts and, you know, any sort of outdoor gear we were selling, and we had a warehouse full of this inventory, and so this system was getting updated in real time. So as orders flowed through, you had to charge a credit card by calling, I think we were using Braintree. Is that the name of it?
Mm-hmm.
Is it Braintree? I think so.
Yeah.
We were calling, I think, Braintree. We were calling to the warehouse to, or we were, I'm sorry, we were reserving the inventory in our own local e-commerce database, but we were also sending the order to the warehouse for them to box up. We were also sending the order to our accounting system so that the accountants would know about it and could make it part of the books, the monthly books. We were sending the user an email with the rundown of their order So you can see right there, just hitting place order was probably, it was spinning off 6 or 7 different background jobs, all of which could act independently from the others, and all of which could fail independently if that third party system was down for some reason.
What if there is some kind of transactionality component where if you have 10 things and any of one of them fails, you don't want to actually go through with all 10 of them. You need to like roll them all back somehow or something like that. Is that a use case that you ever see?
Not really, because usually your transactions are going to be something that you do just in time. So the user hits place order, for instance. Now, transactionally, you want to make sure that you have enough inventory and you want to be able to charge their credit card, right? Because if either of those fail, you don't want the order to be placed and you want the user to see an error message. So we would reserve the inventory and then we would call out to the merchant to actually charge the card or authorize the card. And as long as both of those succeeded, then we would go and we would spin off all the background jobs to do the rest of the work.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point, because it's not as if you would want to, you do all that stuff and, oh wait, we can't report it to the accounting system, so actually you can't buy this thing.
Yeah, like, until you actually charge the credit card. Once you charge the credit card, then you've got a whole separate set of processes that need to kick off, right? If you want to do a refund, if you want to cancel the order, there's a lot more work that has to happen once you pass that point of no return.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Let's see. It's probably getting close to time to start thinking about winding down the episode, because I know we got a time constraint coming up here. Where should people go if they want to, let's say somebody has never used Sidekick and they want to get, let me ask that. If I've never used Sidekick and I just want to spin up a pretend project just to try it out and get a little bit of experience, do you have any recommendation for like maybe a fake project that somebody could create that could help them do that?
Oh, wow. That's a hard question, actually. I don't know of a good beginner app. But I would say that it's really easy to get started with Sidekick. I do have a Getting Started wiki page on the Sidekick project that shows you in like 3 lines of code how to integrate it into a Rails app. So it should be really easy for people to integrate it into their own Rails app. And if it's not, then I want to hear about it. And what the struggle was, because I definitely want to make it very easy to people to onboard onto Sidekick.
My experience was that it was in fact trivially easy to get it going on a Rails project.
Yeah, and I think that would actually be more valuable to people instead of having to get this sort of random app that has no sort of tie to the person. If they can integrate it into an app that they do use day to day, that's far more valuable to people. So I would point people to the wiki. Sidekick has a crazy amount of quality documentation because it's my full-time job. I mean, we didn't talk about the commercial side, but I mean, I've built a business on top of Sidekick, and for that reason, I'm paid to keep the documentation up to date, to keep the code quality high. So hopefully people will find it really easy to use.
Yeah, I've actually had to exercise some discipline on myself and not ask a whole bunch of questions about the entrepreneurial side of it, because that's something I have an interest in. But I did happen to listen to your Indie Hackers interview, and if anybody's interested in that side of it, I would definitely recommend that Indie Hackers interview, because you kind of told your story of how it got created. And I don't know, this was like a while ago when you did this interview. Do you remember when was that?
Some
months ago.
I want to say it was 2 years ago, if not 3 years ago.
Really? Man,
I'm going to say 3 years ago.
What? Let me look.
Fall 16?
Not that I don't believe you, but 16? Just like, I'm gonna
Google
Mike.
Was it fall 16 or fall 17? It was one of the two.
Let's see. Episode 16, apparently, of Indie Hackers. I don't know if they're going to have any kind of a timestamp on here or whatever. I'm not seeing it immediately. Oh, I can judge by the comments. Looks like the comments were like 2 years ago. Man, if I had to
So fall 17.
Yeah, wow. I would have guessed that that was like 6 months ago, just based on my sense of time. But obviously, I was way off. As you get older, time just starts flying by. It's crazy.
Sure, sure.
Okay. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, and so yeah. I mean, that was 2 years ago. So maybe it's time to update that. And so if you wanted to do a part two of the podcast or talk more on the business and commercial side, I'd be happy to chat with you or anybody else that wants to discuss that.
Oh, that would be great. I may well take you up on that. But as for now, let's wrap it up for today. Mike, where should people go to find out more about Sidekick and all that kind of stuff?
Well, you can go to the GitHub repo, which has the wiki. And my personal site is mikeparam.com. So I blog all about Sidekick and Ruby and my other project, Factory, which is a background job system for every programming language, not just Ruby. So that's a whole nother ball of wax. Check out the GitHub repo and get started there.
Awesome. Well, Mike, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jason. It was my pleasure.